The Transfiguration Gospel is placed very carefully in the liturgy. It comes today because we are about to enter this week the most important and most holy time of the year, the time when it matters most what we do, the time when all the resources of our faith are standing ready for us. These offer to each of us an opportunity to grow in the Spirit for personal transfiguration or transformation, if you will. The Transfiguration of Jesus stands in a tradition of Old Testament mountaintop experiences, theophanies, as they are called, moments when God reveals himself, speaking to someone in a time of need or crisis or change, to a person who really wants to hear. An obvious connection is to that of Moses receiving on Mount Horeb the stone tablets containing the law, the Ten Commandments. This is obviously a foundational story in the history of Israel. It's more than full of inspiration and is definitely worthy of extensive study, reflection, and prayer. It comes from the desert time, the 40 years during which the Hebrew people wandered in the desert after their flight out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, and before they entered the Promised Land under Joshua. But another Old Testament mountaintop experience is referenced in the Transfiguration of Jesus as well. And that is the one I want to focus on today. Hundreds of years after the face of Moses shone on Mount Horeb in the presence of the Lord, the great wonder worker and prophet Elijah returned there in a time of corruption, difficulty, and persecution, wondering what he should do next. He was seeking guidance, wisdom, God. His story provides a reference point for all of us who are faithful enough to bring the real questions and difficulties of our life story to God and to wait patiently for the answer. And people have always struggled with this. How to ask? How to speak to God about what's happening? How to know if there's been an answer? How long to wait? How could God possibly speak to me? Elijah's experience on the mountain has provided answers to generations of those who seek the mind of God. The context is that of a conflict between Elijah and the king, Ahab, and his wife Jezebel, over the faithfulness of Israel to Yahweh. Although the name Jezebel is most infamous in popular culture in association with sexual promiscuity and quote-unquote feminine wiles, there is really much more to it than that. The biblical story in 1 Kings is layers deep in political and social complexity. The essence of the conflict with Elijah is that the queen, Jezebel, is a Phoenician, not an Israelite, a Phoenician, a foreigner who has brought with her from her home in Tyre the worship of foreign gods and goddesses. Worst of all, King Ahab has joined her in that worship. Since their entry into the Promised Land centuries before, the Jewish people have been surrounded by people like Jezebel, who followed the Canaanite religion. There were always some who were tempted by it. Images of sexual promiscuity, prostitution, and unfaithfulness abound in Bible passages describing the temptation of the people to wander away from Yahweh to neighboring small g gods. In the biblical context, the promiscuity of which Jezebel is accused is in fact religious rather than sexual. That's just the metaphor that the Bible uses. The two religions stood in profound contrast. Judaism was and is monotheistic, worshiping one God who is beyond the human, is of no specific gender, is the one and only God from before time, and is therefore the creator and God of all things. Canaanite religion, in contrast, was polytheistic, worshiping many different gods, the Baals and the Asherahs, as they're called, masculine and feminine gods with very various specific portfolios: rain, wind, thunder, fire, agriculture, fertility, and the like. As the worship of these gods often involved the worship of idols, literally small statues thought to be the gods in themselves, the Jewish people considered this worship literally idolatrous. It is likely that Jezebel brought a specific form of this religion, common in Tyre and Sidon, and focusing on the god Melkart, who is associated with storms and wind. Asserting the superiority of her god, Jezebel has killed the prophets of Yahweh with Ahab's assent. In response, Elijah has done something well-meaning but horrible. In his zeal to prove the superiority of God, he has killed the prophets of Baal with his sword, about 450 of them. Again, something he means well, but it's an atrocity. Elijah has not yet had the benefit of the transfiguration, we might think, given his action. He's still in the old way. He and humanity in general has not yet seen that the power of the one God is not in the sword, but in the heart. This is where Peter and James and John are on the mountain near Caesarea Philippi, as we heard in our gospel reading. They want to build little huts and have Jesus stay with them there in the old way of Elijah and Moses, which is about killing off the opposition and not about dying to it. I want to be clear here that I am not criticizing or condemning Moses and Elijah here at all. They helped us to take big steps toward the revelation of the true God, who is completely without violence or darkness. The Old Testament records very plainly and courageously that they were faithful, but they were not there yet. Nor are we. The transfiguration is still in the future for us. Perhaps we're here to take a step toward it today. The obvious response of Jezebel to Elijah is to threaten further retaliation, and Elijah is worried about that. He's worried about being killed himself. Facing what he believes is the annihilation of his people, he goes back to Mount Sinai, back to Mount Horeb, where Moses had received the commandments and met face to face with God. He goes back there. And Elijah is the only person the Bible records as returning there, to the one place where God has been known to speak. And here's how the Bible records his meeting, Elijah's meeting with God on Horeb. At that place, he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" The voice from the silence has more to say to Elijah, and Elijah has more to say to God. But I'm going to stop there because I think it's the most helpful place for us to be right now. Here is that moment again, this time from the King James Version. After the wind, an earthquake. Remember that Melkart is the god of wind and storms. After the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. And it was so when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" It is that still, small voice that I invite us all to listen for in Lent and in preparing for Lent. Find a time and a place where you can have complete solitude, even for a few minutes. Nobody around, no distractions, nobody to look after, nothing electronic to play with. Leave your phone in the other room. Turn off or leave the phone at home. It's really, really hard to do, but I always feel happy when I do it. Turn off the lights even. Or go be out in an actual cave or beach or forest or mountaintop if you've got one. Or come here. The church is often a very, very good place to listen to the still small voice. And it's available. It's often very quiet here during the week. So go wherever you can be still and undistracted and in solitude and wrap your face in your mantle, as it were, like Elijah, and stand at the mouth of the cave with Elijah. Listen for the still small voice. If it doesn't come that day, keep listening. Try again the next. You may become aware of the voice, hear the voice, without knowing immediately what it is saying to you, only that it is speaking. Stay with that. Listen as long as you need to. Wait for the Lord. Trust that voice. Bear in mind that the Lord won't be in the storm wind, or the earthquake, or the fire, or in any of the conflicts that are around us. But in stillness, in quiet, in peace, in the sound of sheer silence, as the Bible expresses it. We may need to be very still to hear it, something we don't naturally do. But if we venture into this place of stillness, we may hear it. And the voice is easily missed. It is so small and so still and so constant. Sometimes I think it's there so much for us that we forget to hear it. It's probably speaking to us now in the quiet, in the stillness we have here and now. When you hear it, if you listen long enough and still enough, you will know the answer to this question. What are you doing here, Elijah?